Our third speaker is a recent immigrant to Seattle, Washington, from California. He's the author of 10 books, including histories of Black & Decker, Ashland Oil, and Raytheon, and a history of John Brown and the six New Englanders who provided him with guns, money, and inspiration, the famous raid on Harper's Ferry. He's the present publisher of Compass, a monthly cultural newsletter. The subject of his talk is Emmy Bradford and the New England Intellectuals. I ask you to welcome Otto Scott. Thank you and good morning. Emmy Bradford was among the fortunate, as are most writers, in a world where the thoughts of most men die in the air they utter. A serious writer without public office, without wealth, without political position, leaves a tangible record of his thoughts and can influence the world, not simply of his time, but sometimes for generations. We cannot tell how long Emmy Bradford's influence will endure, though we do know that it has been significant among those of us who are members of his generation. We know also that we cannot know the significance of our own lives. The value of any life can only be assessed after the traveler's journey has ended and is then reached by others. When I learned that Emmy Bradford had untimely departed from among us, my first thought was that the American nation had lost a great man. Who had lost his chance to become a national figure through the machinations of individuals who had special political purposes to advance. They chose an unscrupulous second-rater in Dr. Bradford's place, a second-rater who later disappointed the nation in the very important field of education, and who even later opened the gate to assaults on our liberties in the name of a war against drugs. The nation lost more than it knew when this man's sponsors managed to keep Emmy Bradford from the national stage. My second thoughts, however, were haunted by an incomplete memory of an article that Dr. Bradford had written some years ago. It appeared in an interesting but unhappily defunct Catholic magazine called Triumph. I made no notes of the article at the time, but it was the first of his that I had read, and it kept reverberating in my mind through years. My files retained only the first half of that article, which was titled Lincoln's New Frontier: A Rhetoric for Continuing Revolution. Thanks to Brent Buzzell II, I was able to contact Mike Lawrence, the former editor of Triumph, and obtain the second and final installment and reread the entire piece. It was published 23 years ago in May and June 1971. It was prophetic, profound, and as fresh as the day it was composed. It opened with the observation that Americans have never been a people in the classic sense. We are, he said, the most self-confident and the least self-conscious of modern societies. Who and what we are, he continued, was contained in a set of sacred but generally extra-legal documents: Declaration, Constitution, Federalists, and all the rest. Their authority is unquestioned, he said, but a detailed examination into their formal properties, and therefore their intrinsic ambiguities, has never been encouraged. This lack of true examination regarding the contradictions between the Declaration, which John Adams described as a war document and only one of a number, and the Constitution, which spelled out the structure of the federal government, and the differing views of the Federalists kept, Bradford believed, these differences between from being hardened by different groups to the extent of conflict. Of course, he accepted the South. Its defeat, he thought, made it an exception to the rule. It remained, he said, something like another country, a heresy bounded by geography, and therefore beside the point in the discussion of America at large. But even if Dixie had, quote, remained obdurate, he added, it could not have altered the national self-assurance of the Union and its grounds. He credited this inattention to our sacred document to the unprecedented pace of the nation, which led us to the top of the wealth of the world in only a few generations, and to what he called our convulsive record until the end of World War II. There are, of course, other reasons for the amazing decline in American culture and leadership since the Civil War, but he was too gracious to mention them. His attention was focused on other issues. The first and most prophetic of these was the observation that, quote, in the last few decades, experience has shaken our self-confidence and intensified our self-consciousness. We have reached a point where easy assumptions about our nature and destiny are no longer convincing. Thus, it is now possible to consider the ambiguities of texture and design in our national weave that make fair to divide us beyond all powers of feeling. Then he said, we are prepared as never before to doubt our secularized eschatology, to examine the roads taken, the evangels heeded, and the prophets deputized lead. There is an emergency in our retrospection on once safe assumptions, which resemble not so much the curiosity of the antiquarian or the animus of the partisan as the anguished confession of the damned. He then set about examining three of the many sacred documents of American history in the climate of 1971. These were the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address, and the Battle Hymn of the Republic. He thought Lincoln was wrong in taking the equality theme from the Declaration, and that his error was put to music by Judy Ward Howe. Lincoln, he pointed out, faced with the need to be reelected, chose not to present the Union case in terms of proposition, discussion, and argument, but into oracle and glorified announcement, an advance from discourse of what is believed to be into an assertion of what must be and yet forever remain in the process. Dr. Bradford noted that Lincoln cast this in biblical language, suited to judges, prophets, and priest kings, who instruct and command without explaining. This is suitable to a closed world. He spoke at a time when Bible worship was common and revivals and new settlements numerous. The sonority of the King James Version carried immense credibility. Lincoln's strategy in the first sentence at Gettysburg, said Dr. Bradford, was to lift beyond discourse, away from the political and into the moral order, what stands in the Declaration, despite its deist reference to the Creator, to be proved and argued. 87 instead of 87 of our fathers claims God for a sponsor and a sanction from out of time for what is done within it. A sponsorship through a righteous blood or genealogy of fathers as opposed to founders, and according to partially mysterious purposes as opposed to reasonable order. Certain men belong to that world by a priori definition. They know it is theirs. Others join the dispensation through the loaning of the established blood, hence brought forth an equivocal phrase, again implying a source other than our fathers themselves, for the new nation which they birthed. The image, it is worth remarking, runs with a full set of corollaries and throughout the speech. Its final result is sacrilege by submerged metaphor, a phony New Testament out of a phony Old, with the dead soldiers for a bridge. I quote this from Dr. Bradford's analysis of Lincoln's rhetoric to provide a sample of his searching and scholarly dissection of what was a transition from politics alone to political religion. He traced Lincoln's inspiration for this to Jefferson's appeal in the Declaration, those echoes of the abstractions of the encyclopedists and their perpetually absent creator instead of history. Dr. Bradford then connected the battle hymn of the Republic with Lincoln's new political religion, which he connected to the New England claim to a special relationship with God. The faith waned with success, but Dr. Bradford reminds us, the eschatology remained, tempered into a sense of responsibility for the nations and the world's moral, economic, and political life. It survived, mundane, yet zealous as before, from John Winthrop and Ben Franklin to the recent Massachusetts anti-draft legislation. This movement towards spiritual arrogance without spiritual substance has been uninterrupted. Indeed, said Dr. Bradford, the now familiar secular liberalism of the American intellectual establishment is the natural issue of the new Jerusalem in the West, by Unitarianism out of internecine strife. Its heart remains faithful to a chosen status, though the chooser becomes some airy zeitgeist, not a living God. Mr. Lincoln's political religion is a statement of the fullest revelation in this sequence, and Mrs. Howe's poem and device for the enactment of that word as law. He cited the passages of the battle hymn and its dedication to total power, and detected a touch of hysteria. Genuinely confident in secure authority, he said, operating from a transcendent ground, was not pushed quite so hard. He noted that the misnamed hymn was married to music based on a real Southern folk hymn describing the way to the heavenly city, a city where there are no politics. The madman of Harper's Ferry is transformed into a Christ figure. His is the redemptive death lifting the weight of a specific wickedness from the armed collective back. Brown, however, was an embarrassing personage. Is Christ himself an embarrassing hero? Is Christ himself which metamorphoses into General Burnside on his way to Virginia. We are prepared, said Dr. Bradford, for peroration, the identification of a socio-political goal, freedom for blacks, evidently with the sacrifice of the cross. She meant every word. It is both surprising and probable that she could have been preceded so boldly, surprising with respect to this historic Christian teaching. Take not my name in vain, was still a commandment in 1862. But probably because of the New England intellectual experience which set the saints aside from that teaching, and what was predictable in her abolitionist Boston is even more an established paradox. We are at ease in Zion because she and Lincoln and the trends they bespoke accomplished their objectives. We do not see the Gnostic quality in the battle hymn because it is now our orthodoxy, even in the most conservative circles. In the end, Dr. Bradford looked at Judy Ward Howe's political partisan Jesus, and said that this examination should, quote, engender in the rhetorically and theologically literate a deep shudder, and should deflate these three holy documents to the status of stratagems. The signers of the Declaration of Independence needed to draw more people into the revolution and to improve its international image. Lincoln needed to obfuscate the facts surrounding Jefferson's composition in order to control the war effort and justify his 1864 re-election. And Mrs. Howe sensed instinctively that the Union's military spirit in late 1861 needed elevation if it were to be sustained against a vigorous enemy. Gnostic rhetoric was needed. And perhaps nowhere else has the millennial impulse been so thoroughly set at liberty within our borders. Only here have men, without major interference, labored a century or more in order to abolish time and repeal contingency. Millennialism always moves from a reaction against the distance separating creation and seeks to make men gods in the human city, the Civitas Dei. With it, we worship ourselves, falsify and forget our birthright. Variety, structure, measure, in any form or differentiated order, the original bill of things as written for our tenure in this place of pest and trial. We are millennialism's enemies. A new beast is always to blame for impediments to man's perfecting will. There is always a new enemy to be attacked. Millennialism is always to come, but not yet. Not till after the next revolution, peaceful or bloody. The freeing, however, is never done. There is no conclusion to the wandering hither and yon in quest of terrestrial beatitude. On to Richmond is through the Promethean will made one with on to Berlin and on to Alpha Centauri, down into the subatomic particle, and finally on through the secrets of the grave. With each new goal, the frustrations born of unfounded expectations come closer and closer to rending man's binding social ties. Said another way, the rhetoric of Gnostic hope can produce only the politics of discontent. For some years, we have been proving out that particular proposition, the basic truth and danger of democracy. The demonstration, he said in 1971, should soon be complete. This was an analysis of our past, a description of the present in 1971, and the prophecy of Mel Bradford for our future at that time. I quoted him at such great length, not simply because of his eloquence, because rereading that article I first saw 23 years ago made me aware of the mystery of influence. Dr. McClellan, who has written books and collaborated with Dr. Bradford, knew him well, described him immensely, described his immensely productive life he is going to. I didn't know him that well. I first read him years ago, saw him only a few times at conferences such as these. I never had a protracted conversation with him, but he influenced me more than I knew until I read that brief two-part article on Lincoln, on what he ironically termed our sacred documents, on the significance of rhetoric and the silly Mrs. Powell. And influence is mysterious because it is intangible. We are moved in ways we do not understand, by sources we easily forget that lodge nevertheless in our subconscious to change our lives. Because the theme, the underlying theme, of that two-part article that I read 23 years ago played a very great role in my writing a book about the six New England idiots who put John Brown up to it. And I had no idea at the time that I wrote the book that Mel Bradford had planted its seeds in my mind. He was therefore a very great influence in my life, of which I was totally unaware until I reread his comments about Lincoln very recently. I did not belong to the circle of Southern writers, poets, and essayists that Dr. Bradford so conspicuously epitomized, but through him I became one of those that reached. I feel immensely flattered to have been invited to deliver this eulogy to him and to his wisdom at this gathering. I believe that as his influence spreads, as it will, that we shall in time create sufficient force to reclaim what was right in our heritage and to discard what has been misrepresented. I believe we are developing in this land, in the private sector, young minds will pour over these words and the words of others here today. They will turn to the work of Dr. Bradford and to Dr. McClellan and to others of us who have written along similar lines, and will reclaim what Mel Bradford